Okay, very welcome back to the programme. A caller says, what message is being given to this county when two child sex abuse cases were given suspended sentences and a third person was distributing images, was also given a suspended sentence, all used addiction as an excuse for their behaviour? It's no wonder these crimes are continuing. There is simply no deterrent. And I think speaking generally, because that's all I can do, it also is very important too, I think, to sort of ascertain where people live and their proximity to schools, etc. Right, now I'm joined in the studio by Danny McFadden, author of Wilder Shores, with Holman Falcarra too. Hi, Danny.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Great to have you with us. How are you keeping?
I'm good, thank you.
Great stuff. Now, Wilder Shores, that was released last year. Is it an autobiography?
Yeah, it's a memoir.
Yeah.
It's a memoir, so it captures a couple of themes. I think my sort of recovery from alcoholism and the second theme is recovering from anxiety. It's the two main themes, but it's also about my background and what happened and where I am today.
And it is a remarkable story, isn't it? You were an alcoholic.
I am an alcoholic, yeah.
Sleeping in parks, homeless. Take us back to then. When was that? And how did you find yourself with that lifestyle?
Well, I never expected to find myself ever. If you asked me at 20 years of age, would I ever end up sleeping in parks or sleeping rough? Of course, I'd couldn't imagine it. But what happened was my drinking steadily got worse, either in London or in Ireland. And my mother got a Resna. I said I wanted to try one more time, you know, to change my life. So she bought me a ticket to Australia. And that was the best thing that, in hindsight, that was the best thing that could have ever happened to me. Because once I got to Australia, I had no support, no family, no friends, no relatives to sort of pick me up, so I ended up on the streets within a very short time. And the good thing about that was that I became very ill. I was suffering from malnutrition, DTs, alcoholic poisoning, you name it. Ended up in hospital, and I was very lucky that one of the nurses introduced AA to me there.
It's remarkable because that was your last chance, but then you got your big second chance, really. Was the notion that you could leave Ireland, you could leave London behind and just completely reset in Australia? And did it last at all, or did you slip into old habits and destitution immediately?
No, I was very lucky. From going to my first AA meeting and making the decision that I wanted to change my life, I haven't had a drink since.
Yeah.
So it's 45 years now, which is, I'm a very lucky man. I think, you know, ending up basically on a rock bottom. Why did I go to Australia? I think part of me was I was so ashamed and so sick of my behaviour in London and around people that in a sense I was going there to get lost.
Mm.
And it was the end of the line for me, really. And I knew once I went, so choosing to go to AA was not choosing to join AA. It was whether, did I want to live or die, really?
Yeah.
So when I said, yeah, I'll go to this meeting. And when I went there, I had a look around. I thought, oh my God, all these old people in their 40s. I was 28, you know, and look at me now. And but I realized but a voice also told me, and part of me said, well, I'll come back when I'm their age.
Mm.
But also a little voice said to me, Danny, you're never going to be their age.
Right.
And I knew that, you know, not a dramatic thing, but I just knew that.
You seem to have a great awareness of your situation, you know, when you were in London, when you were in Ireland, and then in Australia. Is that common, do you think, that sort of, you seem to know that you're in a bad situation, that things are desperate, that I need to do something. It's not necessarily the story we often hear when we speak to people who are alcoholics.
Well, I knew I was chronic alcoholic when I was 18.
Yeah.
And I think it was because my father was an alcoholic. So I was brought up in that kind of thing, and I knew very quickly. And when I was young, I said to myself, I'll never be like Dad. But what could I do? I couldn't control it. I was exactly the same. So I had that realization, but just realizing you have this drug addiction, the problem is, what do you do about it? And then the nightmare is trying to manage the drinking and then the anxiety and treating the anxiety with alcohol, which never ever works.
Well, it amplifies it, doesn't it?
Exactly.
And did you, we'll talk about your anxiety, but initially, was drink there to sort of blunten that, to give you a bit of confidence as well? I mean, obviously you're growing up at a time and in a community where, you know, drink is ever present. That's, you know, that's just the way it's easing now, but it was the way it was. I mean, obviously probably it was expected that you would drink, but were you medicating your anxiety at that time as well?
Yeah, I realised I was. And I realised now, looking back when I was writing the book, I realised how much. And in a sense, it was quite logical, because it's the only thing that gave me any kind of confidence or peace of mind. So, for instance, if I wanted to meet people or, you know, have any interaction with people, which was always a really brought on anxiety with me, two or three drinks would sort of level me out so that I could actually cope. And it was the only thing was, I knew it was an illusion, because I knew sooner or later the alcohol or the drugs were going to wear off.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. You have obviously you had an addictive nature, which would, you know, which would talk to your alcoholism. But you're also a young, handsome man in the 60s, right?
The 60s, that you could do a lot of things in the 60s that you couldn't get away with now, I can assure you.
Yeah, did you find you couldn't dip in and out of stuff, though, that if you sort of experimented with a drug that you found yourself?
I suppose in a way, Greg, I was lucky, because heroin hadn't really hit big then. And the thing was dope, you know, marijuana was big, but marijuana always made me feel morose and brought me down. So I much preferred the excitement of drink. And so I never really got, I would smoke for companionship, but I never really got into...
Wasn't your thing.
Acid I got into, LSD, which was, as you may know, that does some strange things to you.
Yeah, hallucinations.
Yeah, if you're away with the fairies. Yeah.
So just, I want to pick up the story from your first AA meeting, but I just wouldn't mind the timeline. So you knew you were an alcoholic at 18.
Yeah.
So you were going from pillar to post. You went to Australia at 28, did you?
Yes, I did.
And how long after you washed up in Australia, effectively, did you go to your first AA meeting? How wide's that window, roughly?
It was probably about 5 or 6 months.
Right, okay. And up until this point, was there anything in you that you thought you weren't achieving? Like, did you find that you had a particular skill that you maybe later on went to lean on, which we'll talk about? Like, did you feel that, you know, you had... unfulfilled potential, or did you hate yourself, or what was your view of yourself?
I was full of shame and self-hatred.
Yeah.
Full of shame, self-hatred, guilt, the eldest son, and, you know, I always felt that very,
so you're hugely self-aware. Again, I'll use that word. You were punishing yourself emotionally and physically.
Yeah, and in a way, going to Australia, the thought was to me, well, if they never see me again, it'll be good for them.
Yeah.
Now, whether that was also me protecting myself, because I couldn't stand the accusatory eyes anymore, you know, the letting people down all the time, which you do, you know.
Right, so you walk into the first AA meeting.
Yeah.
Pick the story up from there.
Well, I walked in, as I said, I looked around, I thought, oh, my God, what am I doing here? You know, these weird people, an American cult of some kind. I had no idea. But one thing I knew is, I went there because there was a group of people there. I knew they were alcoholic and they were sober. So I didn't care about any of the slogans on the walls. I didn't complicate things. I thought, I'll keep coming, because somehow hanging around with these people, I can, and then that will give me a chance perhaps to see what life could be. You know, what was the life that I could have? You know, what possibilities could I have? I wasn't thinking of it so clearly then, but somehow being around these people and listening to them, and later on, working on myself with the 12 steps of AA, which I'm sure you've heard heard of many times.
And how quickly did you sort of start seeing the wood for the trees, if you know what I mean, light at the end of the tunnel? Because, I mean, for 10 years up until then, you know, a bit of self-loathing, taking an awful lot of blame on yourself, alcohol, drugs. Like, how soon after that first meeting and the progress in the 12 steps did you start Was it like a rebirth or something?
It was,
I'm just curious as to what changes in that time.
I went, for instance, during those 10 years, I'd gone on many geographicals. I'd worked in Denmark. I'd worked picking grapes in France. I was always running away, looking for. And the only problem was wherever I went, I always found myself at the other end, and it always ended up in a mess. I was always running out of town, so to speak, because I'd leave in this.
It's like trying to run away from your shadow in the desert.
Yeah, exactly. How can you run away from your own shadow? And this is a good analogy. But the kind of payback was very quick for me because I'd been living on the streets, and they gave me the opportunity to go into rehab, which is a very small hospital in a place called Geraldton. It's only 12 beds there. And I was sleeping in a bed for the first time in a long time. I was showering every day. I was having food. So that kind of feedback, and I was still a young man. So my physical recovery, I felt very, very quickly within 2 or 3 months.
You were able to bounce back.
Yeah, and they were giving me work. I was going out working on farms. You know, you could have a day kind of work.
I'm sorry to ask this question. Yeah. It's probably not the right time, but as a parent, were you able to feed this information back to your late mom? Was she able to see?
Eventually, okay. Yeah, eventually. And she did. She got to see me, fast-forwarding very, very, very much. When I became admitted as a solicitor in the UK, I didn't realise, I did the exams in Australia because I was a solicitor there. And when I got to the UK, I didn't realise that they were actually going to have a graduation ceremony.
For you, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know that. And so Mum was able to come down to the Royal Society. And
that's brilliant. I'm delighted about that.
That was very moving for him to see, for my mother to see that,
Yeah, unbelievable. This person that she said goodbye to, not recognisable.
Well, Mum was very clever because later on I said to her, Mum, what did you ever think? She says, she was a Limerick woman. She said, I used to always pray for you. I said, she said, yeah, I always used to pray to St. Jude. And I thought nothing of this until a Beatles song came out, and then I remember reading somewhere St. Jude, the patron saint of lost causes.
That's what I was going to say. I thought it was lost causes. Well, anyway.
And I thought to myself, I burst out laughing when I knew this. I thought, well, Mum knew her saints, you know.
Yeah. I was so curious about whether your mum got to see it. I had to ask that question at that point in time.
She did,
but anyway, that's good. That's really good. Right. So listen, I mean, there's so much here. We are going to have to skip a bit. So, right. When you decided that you were going to sort of go on and study in Australia, what directed you and what made you so ambitious?
I think it was the me coming out that was always meant to be.
Like you shed your skin, really.
Yeah, it's exactly that. This was the person that, without the drug addiction, that could be. Now, I didn't know who that person was. For instance, when my first big step was when I was in a bush town. I went bush from when I left rehab. I went bush. And I ended up being the town librarian. So, you know, God loves a joke.
Yeah.
You know? I'm lying on the streets in the next town 9 months before, and then I'm the town. Anyway, so that was the beginning of really being handed back. When I got the job of the town librarian, the lady who was taking over in the interim, she stayed there for the first week, and then on the Friday she said to me, oh, Danny, I forgot. And she walked back into the library and she handed me the keys. She said, these are yours now. And I just knew it was literally being handed my life back again.
Amazing.
You know, so she handed me the keys and I had some books and I pretended to drop them because I didn't want her to see the tears in my eyes because I realised the significance. And it was up to me then what I did with it, you know.
Yeah, so from librarian to...
Yeah, well, I used to watch the ABC TV in Australia. It was always this, still have the very English orientation.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, I'm in Asia. Why, we're so close to Asia. Why is there no news about Asia? And then I was reading the Sunday paper and there was a degree in modern Asian studies. And the state librarian of Western Australia, he gave me a reference and they accepted me. So I bought a combi and drove across the Nullarbor, which is 3,000 miles or something, and drove across in my second-hand combi to Brisbane and started university.
And what was that like?
It's horrible because it was the worst year of my life because my anxieties came back 100-fold And so I was five years sober or something. So that my underlying problem, which was me, was chronic anxiety. The universe of my higher power said, now you've got time to deal with it.
Mm.
And it was horrible. And I think it was because I was amongst all these young people, and I was 30-something, 33. And I just felt like a fish out of water, and I wanted to do so well, and am I good, and all this kind of stuff.
Are we catastrophizing and all that
Yeah. Oh, it's a horrible year. I used to sometimes, and I'd go to a lecture, and I couldn't even put my hand up to ask a question. And I would get so frustrated, I'd sometimes go into the toilets and cry because of that anxiety, which I, you know. Yeah. But anyway, I did somebody...
Well, what worked for you with the anxiety?
Well, what happened, I went to something, a course called self-help for self-esteem, something like that. How I got there, I don't know. But I went there and they said, why are you here? And my worst nightmare was to stand up in front of a crowd of people and speak. And anyway... I stood up and I was blushing and trembling and everything. And I said, I'm here because I'm terrified. And I didn't mean to say that. I meant to say I'm here because, you know. And so during the break, this I was standing there hiding behind a cup of coffee. And this really cool-looking lady started walking towards me. I thought, oh, my God, what does she want? And she came, I thought she's going to be a God botherer, you know, as they say in Australia. And she came up to me. And she says, oh, I used to have anxiety too. And she said... There's a book by Dr. Claire Weeks called Self-Help for Your Nerves. And she wrote it down for me. And I thought, what would she know about bloody anxiety? Look at her. She's as cool as a cucumber. Mm. She's so relaxed. But I got that book and I used the... And I found out later that, everything about it. I mean, Self-Help for Your Nerves, what a silly title, you know, old-fashioned. But I found out later this doctor, and she became very well recognized in America... She knew some methodology, some, you know, cognitive therapy that worked for people with anxiety. And, for instance, I came in here today. If I was feeling anxious, I'd start to float. So I'd see myself floating. It's a concept, you know. It started to make my life bearable.
Mm.
But that was actually quite
difficult. Did you find it difficult to open to that stuff? Because obviously you're a critical thinker, right? You're very self-driven. Probably in elements of life you feel you know, not know it all, that sounds like in a bad way, but not. Did you find it difficult to open sort of your mind to, you know, someone else's take that on the face of it doesn't seem like how that could work? Do you know? Do you get where I'm coming from?
I understand that, Greg. Well, what I had was the gift of desperation.
Yeah.
So both with my drinking and my anxiety, I had nowhere else to go. I would have...
So this was anxiety rock bottom.
Yeah. And so I had nowhere else to go. I would try anything. Except drugs. That's the only thing. I knew that wasn't the answer. And that was actually quite painful because, you know, with mental issues, it's not such, you know, you don't just go from A to B in a straight line. And sometimes I felt like I was a frog climbing out of a well. Mm-hmm. I'd climb up three and then fall back four sometimes. And I'd get quite angry. I mean, I'd get quite angry at God, you know. Say, well, isn't it bad enough being alcoholic and a drug addict without giving me all these issues?
Okay.
But, you know, anyway.
Well, listen, we're in conversation here with Danny McFadden, who is an author and has a remarkable story. We've heard of his time on the streets of London, on the streets of Australia, through AA, on to his studies. You obviously qualified then in your Asian studies course, okay? So what comes next? Because where we're going to end up, by the way, listener, is Danny working in conflict management around the world, mediation, dispute resolution, and we'll get to that. But just fill in the blanks between, your qualification and how your career progressed from there.
Yeah, well, my life's never gone in a straight line.
Sounds like it.
No, someone gave a review to the book and said, "My, Danny's life doesn't make sense," and I suppose it doesn't in sort of a linear sort of sense or going in a straight line. But when I was at university, one of the Chinese teachers there, because we could choose an Asian language, and I chose Chinese. I was terrible at it, by the way, and that's not false modesty. But we had a new Chinese teacher, and she had a lot of connections, or guanxi, as they call it in Chinese, with the education department in Taiwan. So she could get us scholarships. And lo and behold, something said to me, go for it. And I said to Elizabeth, you know, my Chinese is not very good. Would I be accepted? And she said, well, if you're willing to try, I'll get you a place. And so I sold the combi for $1,000 and that bought the ticket to go to Taiwan. And then I found myself studying Mandarin at university in Taiwan.
Did you find Mandarin easier to pick up in sort of that more immersed environment?
Yeah, well, I was very lucky because very few people in Taiwan in those days spoke English, and same in China when I later on went to China. So I was very lucky to see the early China and Taiwan. But, you know, Mandarin, for those people who are studying it, it is a very difficult language. Mm. I also speak Indonesian, and what I found is Indonesian, for instance, English, they're easy at the beginning. You can, you know, good morning, how are you, etc. And so you can actually converse quite quickly. But with Mandarin, it's the opposite. The beginning is very tough. You've got tones, you've got, you know, script, you've got all that stuff. And then it gets easier. So sadly, and my fellow students in those days, some would drop out then. Mm. Although every month I threw my books at the wall and said, I've had enough. Mm. You know? I'm sick of this baby talk, because you don't make progress. At least I didn't very quickly. Mm-hmm. But I've later gone on to... You know, very lucky that I work in Mandarin, I train in Mandarin.
And obviously to those, in terms of your career progression and your opportunities, being a fluent Mandarin speaker, Indonesian, and obviously English, very useful.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So qualify in Taiwan with then?
Well, I got a diploma in Mandarin, mm-hmm. and I was supposed to go there for a year and ended up there... That's over 2 years.
So what did you start studying next?
I went back and I finished my Modern Asian Studies degree. I looked around for work involving Chinese. Wasn't much around, even though the Australian government in those days was pushing everyone to learn Mandarin. it wasn't quite accepted in business circles. I called one coal company who did business with China, and he said, oh, mate, we don't have anyone... speaking Chinese here. We got a bloke speaking Italian, but, you know, he didn't want to give up the trips to China and the massage and the banquets, you know. He didn't want an expert like me getting in the way, you know.
All right, you were blocked.
Yeah, I was blocked every time. But I did find work with a wonderful guy, an entrepreneur in Australia, and that took me into China and various other ventures, you know.
Did you learn from him as well, sort of in terms of...
Yeah, I learned when I was in Taiwan. I ended up working for Chinese business people there who are still my friends. And I learned more about business from sort of shadowing them around than I could learn in any sort of masters, I think, because the Chinese are incredibly good at business, as you know.
Yeah, indeed. Now, you became the director of the Centre for Effective Dispute Resolution, right? What was the role, or what is the role of that?
Yeah, well, the CEDA, the Centre for Effective Dispute Resolution, is Europe's largest, you could say, mediation body. And that happened, I'd been a lawyer in Brisbane for about 5 years. I decided to spend some time with Mum in Kentish Town, and because I'd been away for so long, I thought, well, I'll go there. And while I'm there, I'll see if I could find a job in law just for the crack. And if it didn't work, I'd go yeah. back to Australia.
It's very impossible to track your career path.
I know,
because,
yeah.
I mean, you've just qualified in Mandarin. You're back doing the Asian studies. And I ask one question, and you're now a qualified lawyer. How in God's name did you become a qualified lawyer then?
Yeah, I don't know. That's it, you know.
That was in Australia, right?
I'd been working for some Chinese entrepreneurs. I had my own real estate company, all this kind of stuff. So I was working with high wealth Asian clients because of my Mandarin and my relationships. So I worked for one guy, and I actually was able, real estate is 24/7. 6 days a week, 7 days a week. If you've got Asian clients, there's no off time. So I was doing that. And then one Asian entrepreneur, he asked me at a venture capital company, he said, work for me. And it was 9 to 5. And at 5 o'clock, I thought, what do I do for the rest of the day? and so I thought, well, I'll see. But what about going to university? And so I went to the Queensland University. And I said to this guy, who's actually Irish, actually, I said, what could I study? And he said, what do you want to do? I said, well, could I be a doctor? He said, yeah, mate. I mean, that was just wonderful, this kind of open attitude. And he, or a lawyer. And I said, oh, okay. And he said, but you'd have to study biology. I said, oh, well, forget that then.
I'll become to be the doctor.
Yeah, I'll become a lawyer. And so I tried it. And my wonderful wife, Teresa, she was working in the bank at that time. She's from Taiwan. I met her in Taiwan. And she said, well, go, you know, so I went to night school and studying law. And then she said to me, do you like it? I said, yeah, actually, I'm surprisingly, I do. She says, well, take 2 years off.
Wow.
And so
that's
did.
That's a big shirt.
So I kind of worked on an accelerated program myself. Part of that was going to America, doing a couple of units at Marquette University in the States, which was wonderful. So there I was, and then I became a commercial lawyer in Brisbane. How did I get that job? I was sending out all my CVs and no replies. And then I met a guy in the gym, and he said his dad was a managing partner of a small law firm. And I told him about me, and, you know, that's like everything. That's the way I got that.
Yeah, but it sounds like you made these opportunities, though, didn't you? I mean, are you just incredibly lucky? Because the way you describe it is, if you fall over, you're landing on your feet, right? But were you, I mean, obviously you were able to see opportunities. You had good support through Teresa.
Yeah,
you're obviously very driven. You know, all of this stuff, whilst there's some interesting angles to it, you had to make the opportunities every time they were presented to you.
Well, what I found is, and I'm not preaching to people, but, you know, you have to do the hard yards.
Mm.
So if I was looking for a job as a lawyer, I had to send out all the CVs. Mm-hmm. I had to cope with all the rejections, which is very difficult. But then, as you say, Greg, when that opportunity came along, it's knowing when to grab it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found is, don't wait until I'm full of confidence, because that day never comes. My knees would be shaking and, you know, and I'd say, I'll have a go.
Okay.
And I think the ability to say, have a go is
not in its crudest sense. Is there any element of fake it till you make it in this story?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And imposter syndrome. Yeah, I suffer from that big time, you know.
Right, so we're going to have to fast forward to the early 2000s. You're involved with Cedar. At what level are you mediating, seeking to... Is this in business? Is it political?
Big commercial cases, you know, two businesses, they're in court, they decide... You know, someone says, well, why don't you pull your head in the Australian term? Why don't you consider solving it? They can't do it themselves, so bring
in...
So
this could be like
professional media
IP encroaching?
Yeah, I mean, the last... I'm talking about IP, the last case I did in Hong Kong, you know, three companies, they're involved in an IP dispute. We spent 2 days trying to resolve it. They settled at some hundred thousands of US dollars. Instead of having a mammoth court case and the stress and all that.
Yeah.
So I was doing those kind of cases and small cases too, neighbourhood cases. So I did a whole range of things and I still do that in Hong Kong.
Are you still involved with Cedar?
Yeah, I was on the phone to them, a Zoom call yesterday. We still do training we actually do a lot of training in Ireland, down in Dublin, which I'm not involved in, funny enough. But we still, you know, provide training in China and places like that.
What was your role with as acting director of mediation at the United Nations in New York? What is your standout role there?
Luck again. I met a guy in Beijing, had a meal, a professor at a university, John Barkat, and then 2 years later, he's the ombudsman for the UN in New York. And he sent me an email saying, we need to set up a mediation division in New York for the UN. Could you come over and do it for us?
Mm. And what were the parties?
Cedar seconded me there, which is amazing.
And were you overseeing that department or were you directly involved in mediation? And I suppose just give us an example of the role of
both,
mediation within the United Nations.
As you know, these international civil service bodies like the UN, they have thousands and thousands of staff around the world and they get into disputes, internal disputes. And so I was both mediating those in New York and plus setting up the office itself. And then it takes time. They move a bit slowly. So they said to me, look, we haven't got a director. Will you come in and act as director until we get one? And so it was wonderful. We were living in Manhattan in 2008 and 2009, beyond my wildest dreams, you know.
What's your tactic, your key thing? Is it to find common ground? Maybe start
try
from
and
there,
find or? Common ground, but you know, there's often not a lot of common ground because if they had any, they wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
It's a tough negotiation. once they build up trust in me and get to know Danny a bit better, then I can be, let's put it this way, a bit, I don't tell them what to do, but I can be very forceful.
Very persuasive?
Well, I can sometimes hold up a mirror and say, you know.
Right, so, I mean, the appointments keep coming. 2010, regional mediator Asians Pacific for the World Bank Group. 22, appointed regional mediator Asia for the International Monetary Fund, the old IMF, who we're very familiar with. And in 23, appointed by the Supreme Court of China as an expert in mediation to assist the China International Commercial Court. I mean, there's no slowdown here. This is we're bang up to current times.
Yeah, well, what I found was, and the same thing, that these chance to networking. When I went to Hong Kong, it's very Asian, but I think in any business, it was a question of networking, you know, working very hard, getting business, getting your name out there.
What's your role with the IMF?
Basically, I was in Beijing 2 weeks ago for the IMF, and then the week before I was in Laos, Thailand, and where else was I? Vietnam, delivering workshops to the staff there and talking about how to deal with internal conflict, you know, that kind of things.
Yeah.
And if they have cases, if they have, you know, employment cases where someone's challenging something, they'll ask me to be the mediator.
And your role with China, you can't say China anymore without that Trumpism coming into it. Supreme Court of China as an expert in mediation to assist the China International Commercial Court. Now, how does that, if any way, overlap with the conversation of tariffs and what have you? What would the role of the International Commercial Court be in China?
Well, they're looking to see if there are, for instance, disputes about, you know, between companies about tariffs, about unfair practices, about, you know, IP issues. That's basically what it's set up for. But when we're talking about, you know, what's happening between, you know, Xi Jinping and Trump, that's at a totally other level. That's sort of like...
Yeah, but you will hear stories whereby as part of the wider situation that the Chinese government will accuse the Americans, say, for instance, of, you know, illegality in the administration of tariffs in certain areas or breaking agreements or what have you. So presume that falls in under that. So all of these roles are ongoing, are they? I mean, where is how in God's name do you manage your time?
I suppose it goes back to the days when I was... You know, basically the early days of working with Asian parties, like for instance, Hong Kong, nobody ever stops. And I should, but I never put out of office on my emails, and it's just a practice. But I'm older now, and I don't chase business.
But you can pick and choose what you wish to do.
I can pick and choose. Like I enjoy working with the IMF, for example. I enjoy... training young mediators. So
you're all over the place still. I mean, where are you next week?
Basically, most of the time, thankfully, up in Dunmore in Farcarra,
right?
Which we got a farm there. I didn't see that one coming either. That's my grandfather's farm.
Okay, so it's your actual grandfather's.
Yes, it is.
You acquired that.
Yeah, the house there is 160 years old, so I've been told, and we've just renovated part of it, saved the roof, so to speak, and that was has very fond memories for me.
Cause I take it you didn't have to get a mortgage.
No, I didn't. No,
I
no.
Not.
I don't think they'd give me the Irish banks to give me much of a mortgage.
Right, I suppose no money joking. And how has Teresa settled to life here?
She loves Donegal. It's much to my surprise. I mean, when I said to her, "How about we buy back the family farm." The first thing she said, "Will we make money?" Because a very, you know, Chinese and very logical question. I said, "Well, I don't know if we'll ever make any money, but it's something I'd like to do."
Or we won't lose any. That's what I was.
Well, I was fingers crossed in those days. Yeah.
Yeah, and the IMF. You know, we had them here. They were here, and we're still really recovering from that. Any commentary in relation to that?
Well, they sometimes do a thankless job, I think. Mm. They have to go into economies that are in turmoil. For instance, Argentina, again, is...
I thought everything was rosy over there. I thought he went in there and got rid of the Department of Education, made these sweeping changes, and Elon Musk is saying we need to be taking this guy's lead.
Yeah, well, it might not be following the IMF rule book on how to do it. But yeah, they respond to, like, they work very hard with places like Laos, you know, which are mid-level developing economies, still with Vietnam, although Vietnam economy is doing very well, although up to now it's still holding its breath about the tariff situation with Trump, because a lot of Chinese businesses, as you know, just once they got heavy tariffs moved all their factories over to Vietnam. And the Vietnamese people are very hardworking. Have you ever been there?
No.
Yeah.
Well, no, I couldn't match a single page of your passport, let alone let alone it in its entirety. No, I am really quite culturally. But listen, if you ever need me to travel with you, you know, do some, I don't know if you're any good in social media, I can do a few Facebook posts for you.
Okay, well, I'll take you up on that. Be careful.
What is China's view of Donald Trump? Do they respect him? Do they think he's a madman? They certainly can't ignore him.
Well, it's strange with China, but people don't quite understand. Like during the 2008-2009 economic crisis, I was traveling around China and all over the place. No one batted an eyelid. Mm. Because, and then with Trump, okay, they don't like some of the things, Trump's tactics. They see it as bullying. Well, it's not me saying it. Xi Jinping, the president, you know, refers to it as, or his spokesman, refer to it as basically bullying. I don't think they realize just how strong China is these days. Mm, you know, you can go to a third-tier city, they're all driving new cars, they're not even thinking about what's happening in the West. Mm. They don't really care about, they've got their own brands, they don't care too much anymore. They used to, about wearing a Nike T-shirt or something. Those days have gone.
I thought it was really interesting, and it was a very shrewd tactic in that some of it was true, some of it not so true, but they were pointing out how cheaply some of the, you know, the high-end brands are made, as if to say, you know, use of the mugs here, we're just walking around with these all of the time. Listen, I mean, I don't believe any of it, Danny. It's that remarkable story. I think you're pulling the wool over my eyes. but it is something else. Are you the same? I mean, you said earlier on, in fact, you corrected me, and I appreciate that, you're an alcoholic.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, with everything that's happened between then and now, and I know it's sort of, you know, part of the program and such, but I mean, you're still the same person fundamentally, not the same, I'm on about the same skin and bones, right? I don't mean the same person that you were then. You can never forget that, I suppose.
No, I don't worry. I don't wake up worrying about being an alcoholic. Mm. I don't fear. I have no fear around alcohol. But I know, but doing basic things, just go to meetings, just try and be as, you know, follow some decent principles, be as honest as I can in my life. Don't get into any, let's put it this way, unhealthy behaviours. That, you know, one day at a time. One day. And I never really ever believed that you could be happy sober. I really was. Mm. I was one of those people that thought, how can you ever? Yeah,
there's no life after drink.
Oh, no. And when I joined AA, I thought, this is the end of my life. Mm. Oh, my God. I didn't realize it's the beginning. Mm-hmm. It was actually the beginning.
Beginning of a remarkable life. And there's key areas. Like, what say that nurse that took an interest in you, say that, you know, the first groups of individuals when you walked into your first AAA meeting, and then there's, you know, others that guided you along the way. Are you the type that's very grateful to that you remember them?
Because you've absolutely, clearly... yeah. I don't remember them in the book. And when I got on my feet, I sent money for the... back to the hospital in Geraldton and said, look, have this for your nurse's Christmas party. And they were quite surprised to get it. And I said, I know you see a lot of people come and go, and it's hard working with addicts, which we are, whether it's drugs or alcohol. Plug for AA and Letterkenny is very strong, and Falcarra and Dunfanaghy everywhere.
So. But the message is still the same. Yeah. I mean, obviously your story has taken a remarkable turn, you know, but that being said, the core message here right now is if someone's listening to this, if they're an alcoholic or if they are addicted, and you start, you're prepared to start that journey, you're at that point where you can, it's relative. Maybe it'll be owning your own property. Maybe it's getting a car. Maybe it's starting a family. It might not be becoming, you know, fluent in different languages or heading up big organisations. It's, you know, what works for you. But, you know, it can be incredibly significant for you. We find our happiness in different ways.
Absolutely. I mean, you could be, why not? But I mean, I actually still like doing, I still like doing physical work. You know, working in the trees, streaming or anything, you know, be the best bricklayer.
I call that flutering.
Flutering.
I've found that as I've got older, I can walk out of the house and the only best way I could be flutter.
Yeah,
move
yeah.
things around in the shed.
Yeah, yeah.
inexplicably.
Yeah, knock a few posts in here and
exactly.
there.
Exactly. Sweep a bit of dust from one corner of the shed to the next and go and look at a hedge. I'm just content by some fluter. And I don't know what the other word is. But
yeah, no, it's a lovely, lovely expression.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, listen, the book is out a bit, obviously, and it's the book's most relevant to our audience. I know you've done other books which specialise in mediation, etc. But the book's called Wider Shores, Wilder Shores, as one person remarked. What was that quote from the person again?
Well, they said Danny's life doesn't make any sense.
Doesn't make any sense. That's it indeed. Well, listen, I'm delighted that you're able to spend time and enjoy Falcarra and Donegal more generally with your wife and what have you. And thanks so much for your story. It's brilliant. Really quite remarkable.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for inviting me along.
Okay, that's Danny McFadden. Back with more after these. By the way, if you're listening to the podcast, we love having you. And also, if you're listening to the overnight repeat, you can WhatsApp 086 60 25,000 or email comments@highlandradio.com if there's something you want to say, and we can pick them up and then carry them into the next live show, and then you can listen them back whenever you're back. Wouldn't it be a great idea for some company to offer a door camera at a reduced price for the elderly? It would be great. I got a doorbell for the house, and I think it was 50 odd quid. It's and someone rings it and it connects. So even if you're in the house, it rings your phone and you just speak to whoever it is. You don't even have to go outside. You know, and it connects to your Wi-Fi. It was like 50 or 60 quid. And also there's no monthly charges with, you stick it on charge, you put it out on your doorbell, and you stick a SIM card in and it records as well who walks past your door, who knocks it. And I've talked again about these cameras that I have outside the house, and they let you know, you can set them, and they let you know as soon as someone walks around your property or to your property, goes straight to your phone, you can open it up, you can even speak to them, you can sound an alarm, you can see and hear what they're saying. You know, and I think those cameras, €65. So, you know, four 65s are what? I know we're talking big money here. So let's say 280 euro plus 70 quid for the doorbell camera. So for €250, you can have two cameras at the back of the house, two cameras at the front, and a doorbell, a video doorbell, all connected to one app on your phone. And maybe you've got someone close to you that can stick them up for you. You know, I mean, that's, you'd have the front, back of your house, and as soon as someone walks past them, there's a light comes on. And as I say, you can have an alarm sounding, you can set them to be armed or not armed. And, you know, that's for 250 quid, four remote cameras, one video doorbell, all connected to your phone, no monthly bills. And you can stick a SIM card in them if you want to archive footage as well. But it also does keep clips which you can grab, and they're really great. Hey, I'm not here to sell them. I don't even the company is foreign, but I'm just saying, you know, for your own security, you can do that. You don't have to wait. What a great Father's Day present, for an example. One camera and one doorbell, you know, €120, all big money, I know, relative to what your income is, but all very affordable, all very actionable. So the two cars, one car stolen from the car park at the hospital and one car at its window smashed, and the Gardaí are looking for witnesses, of course. I don't think they've caught who's responsible. we've talked about the cost of car parking at Letterkenny and what is the function of the cost, right? I mean, I would have thought there'd be good security there. How can someone go into that car park, steal a car and drive out of it? And, you know, what's the CCTV coverage like, for an example? Are there any questions that might need to be asked in that regard? I didn't want to say that while the guards were on, because it's none of their business as such, you know, in terms of getting involved in those convos. But I just thought a little bit... it would make me want to ask a question or two. And a caller asked the same question. Is there no CCTV in Letterkenny Hospital car park because you have to pay to park? Maybe there is. The Gardaí will always make an appeal to strengthen a case, potentially. A caller says, when you call the Gardaí to report suspicious activity, it could be up to 2 hours before they arrive. That service just doesn't work, they say. But it does help to build sort of a pattern of movement as well, so it's not useless. A caller says, is it not illegal to cut hedges from March onwards, Greg? Out at Letterkenny Road was cut yesterday. I don't know for sure. And those conversations come up really quite regularly. What an amazing story from Danny, and what an amazing man. Met him through a mutual friend some years ago in Asia. Thanks. That comes in from Declan McFadden, Galway, Singapore. Thanks, Declan, for your input. Indeed, he's a remarkable gentleman. I live in Porthall. There are a number of dogs in the area. They bark all night. The council have been notified and the dog warden has been out, but nothing has changed. People can't sleep with the noise. The owners let the dog dropping sit outside the house with the good weather coming. How will we cope with the smell? Can anyone tell us where to go from here? So the council have been notified. Is there an issue in terms of their care? Maybe the IRSPCA might have an interest in it. Maybe give them a call, see what they might say. I don't know. Listen, I haven't been able to get to a fraction of your calls and comments. Please don't be discouraged. It's very much appreciated. I want to say that Anne and Alec Carlin, St. Johnson, it's their 50th wedding anniversary today. Lots of love from Teresa and Anthony and all the family. And that's where we leave it on the show today. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning, bright and early. Well, it's not really early, is it? 9 a.m. So please remember to rejoin us.